Hi, good evening, and happy Hanukkah, Hanukkah Sameach. I'm Yaakov Katz, a senior fellow at the Jewish People Policy Institute, and I'm joined this evening by Laura Kim, who is the communications director for JPPI and a longtime veteran Israeli media consultant. I'm also joined by Professor Michal Bar Asher Siegel, who is at Harvard University. Michal is joining us, and there's a lot to talk about when it comes to Harvard, definitely these days. So we will get to that in a brief moment. But before, obviously, lots going on here in Israel, on the ground in Gaza. The offensive continues. Lots of fierce fighting, an aggressive offensive by Israel in this kind of last weeks of a push to the Hamas strongholds of places like Khan Yunis, Jabalia, Sajaiya, and others. Lots of potential Hamas suspects arrested today. Unfortunately, there are also casualties on our side, a farmer who was killed by an anti-tank missile in the north, as well as probably some news that we'll hear later in the day, maybe this evening, of what's been happening also in Gaza. But for today's episode, to maybe commemorate Hanukkah just a bit and the defeat of light, or the victory of light over darkness, we're going to talk a bit about Israel diaspora relations. And I did an interview yesterday with Julie Platt, who is the chair of the Jewish Federations of North America. They've been very active now in raising funds and in helping to support the state of Israel. Julie was one of the speakers at the mass rally in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago. And she is the wife of Mark Platt, who's a well-known movie and film producer, and the mother of Ben Platt, who from Dear Evan Hansen, apparently, not that I've ever seen it, but heard it's really good. So she also has a lot of ties with the whole Hollywood or entertainment industry. We kind of spoke about what they've been doing and their silence to some extent, some people, but also others who have really stood up with what's happening in the war of Israel's war against Hamas. So here's the interview with Julie Platt, and then we'll get to Laura and Michal. Julie, it's great to have you with the Jewish People Policy Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So we're talking, it's a few weeks after the big rally that took place in Washington. There still is in this massive increase, almost an explosion, I guess we could call it, of anti-Semitism, of a feeling of insecurity. So I'm curious, you know, just to start us off, you were one of the speakers at the rally that drew over around 300 and something thousand people, which was very impressive. But it's not enough, I'm guessing, right? So where are your thoughts at the moment with how the battle needs to continue on the ground, particularly in the United States on behalf of the Jewish community?
Sure. I have to say that was a great moment. It was 11 days from idea to execution, which is just rapid fire for the Jewish community to organize themselves and get to work and make something happen. And we needed it. It was a reinvigoration that we're going to need for the long haul to know what happens when you build it and they all come. So that felt great. And I'll also add to that that though 300,000 people were there in person, we understand that 250,000 were online watching it live streamed at the same time. That's a lot of American Jews participating in some way, and it felt great. That being said, it's all hands on deck. I mean, we have to be relentless, and there's no room for fatigue in the fight against anti-Semitism from the schools, if you can imagine elementary school, middle school, high school, you know, on college campuses, and then at every level of government, starting from boards of education and city councils. It's, you know, we talk a lot about, and I'm sure, Yaakov, you've heard Eric Fingerhut, my partner CEO, speak about the fire department, that we built the fire department across the globe so that when the fire happened, we were ready. It's similarly so in community relations. You can't start now having relationships with your mayors and your city councilmen. That's the work of federations across the system to make sure those relationships are in place so that they are our allies when despicable acts happen, and even just to speak loudly against anti-Semitism. So we are activated everywhere with everyone. We don't have the option to not be full in.
Right. I remember when early on in the conflict, you and Eric announced a campaign to raise about $500 million. I think you've surpassed that.
We have.
By quite a bit. So where does that stand? And where's that money? Where are those resources going towards?
Sure. So we're creeping up on $700 million. We don't have a goal anymore, because we are aware, as I'm sure you are, that the needs are going to be endless. And we're also not looking at this as an immediate need fulfillment, but immediate, midterm, and long-term. We're in it with the people of Israel until the rehabilitation and rebuilding and vibrancy returns to the state of Israel. We've allocated over $200 million of that already on the ground in Israel. This is all pretty quick, if you can imagine. And we have funded already about 300 NGOs. The sort of top line organizations that, of course, you will know are the Jewish Agency for Israel, JDC, World Ort, the Israel Trauma Coalition, United Hatzalah, Magen David Adom, Zaka, Chabad, and over a dozen hospitals and medical organizations. And within our 146 federations, there's about 40 of them that have direct relationships, and even many with professionals on the ground who have partner communities or partner organizations where they are directly allocating on the ground. That's all part of this $700 million and all very well organized, cooperated, and aligned.
That's a lot of money that, and a lot of money is needed, unfortunately, for the rebuilding that will have to take place definitely the day after for people to
exactly.
be able to come home, which is going to be, like you said, the long term. I know that you JFNA was involved in the event that took place this week at the United Nations, which finally, after, I mean, it's hard to believe, but 2 months into this conflict, pretty much, the world is finally starting to come around a bit and openly recognize and admit that, yes, it seems that there was some sexual violence against, and rape, of course, very violent, against victims of the attacks on October 7th. But it took a long time for that to happen. You know, what's your take? Why is it so difficult? First of all, tell us about the event, but also why do you think it's so hard, Julie, for people to just say, yeah, women were sexually assaulted, and like we stand with all women, we're also going to stand with Jewish women?
Oh, I don't know the answer to that. If I did, I'd be wiser than all of us put together. The Jewish community had to get their act together about how to fight, how to push back, but they had to get over their heartbreak first. It's pretty heartbreaking to show up for women's organizations and to walk shoulder to shoulder and then be abandoned in this moment. So we had to figure it out. There were many people whose minds went into that UN hearing that took place yesterday. I will shout out to the First Lady of Israel, who began with a video that she shared that was shared broadly here, coupled with Sheryl Sandberg, who created a video that went everywhere to everyone, that was very helpful in bringing about this hearing. Coupled with the leadership of federations and very much Sheila Katz, the CEO of the National Council for Jewish Women. And our National Women's Philanthropy and women's leaders helped to rally what was an oversubscribed event within minutes. The moment the call came out to, we need you at the hearing, I believe I originally heard there were 700 seats. I think that was expanded, but there was a waiting list immediately, because there was a gratefulness, a gratitude on our part that finally someone was going to listen. I understand there were 40 countries represented in the room. I saw a list yesterday. I can't recall them to you. But I also know that it was one of the most heartbreaking and difficult assembling of speakers I've ever heard in my life. Which included first responders that were flown in from Israel and included a gentleman who's doing God's work in Zaka. And it was awful and important and necessary.
I want to go back for one moment to the anti-Semitism issue that we did speak about. You commissioned a poll at JFNA, which came out a few weeks ago, and spoke about how I think it's 2/3 of about 60. Where is it? Sorry, let me pull it up again. It is 3/4. Sorry, 3/4 of U.S. Jews who fear for their safety following the war in between Israel and Hamas. A poll that was commissioned by JFNA. You know, one of the things when I think about this is obviously, look, anti-Semitism is physical, but it's also spiritual. It also impacts people's identity. And the more that a Jewish person feels under attack could lead to one of maybe a bunch of different ways, but one of the responses might be, let me hide my Judaism. I don't want to flaunt it. I don't want to be a prominent Jew. I don't want people to know I'm Jewish. What do you do with that concern? Because that would be a huge victory for our enemies.
So I'm going to answer you in an anecdotal answer and then in the Live Secure answer. So the anecdotal is one of my dear partners in this work is Michael Tushin, who's the chair of APAC. He's also on the board of the Federation here in Los Angeles, where I live. And Michael's house, as you know, was defamed and a protest took place in his front yard. And Michael's action was to get on a plane the next day and go to Israel. Clearly in defiance of anybody telling him what or how he will live his life as a Jew and as a pro-Israel advocate. So that's an anecdotal response that I support and will do exactly as he has. But the second part of this is, I hope you're aware of Live Secure. And that's my answer to what you have raised. Live Secure was an initiative of the Jewish Federations of North America. Unfortunately, we sort of maybe knew we needed this. We never could have imagined we'd need it in the way we do now. But we launched a campaign to secure the North American Jewish community in, I guess, 2021, and raised a very large pool of matching funds and made it possible for every Jewish community to apply for grants, matching grants, to provide the security, the assessments, the training for their community. Because if you're afraid to walk into a Jewish space, how are we going to have flourishing Jewish communities? So I truly believe that as long as we are attentive and take care of the security of the North American Jewish community, we won't need to hide, and people will be able to engage in Jewish life.
Before we wrap up, Julie, I mean, you personally, your family has a lot of strong ties within the, I guess, the Hollywood industry, if we could call it that. There's been a lot of talk of how celebrities, have they been vocal enough? Have they not been vocal? What position they've taken? There's been some that have, some that haven't. There was an example the other day of Arnold Schwarzenegger, a former governor, though, who met with families of hostages who are being held in the Gaza Strip. And there have been others who have been very outspoken. I'm curious what your sense is, as someone who's close to this world, what has your sense been of how that industry has been responding?
Sure. So I will say that it has been a call to action of those who were already engaged in the Jewish community, of which there are many, to call upon their entertainment colleagues, both Jewish and not Jewish, to show up. The fear of calling out someone has disappeared. You see it loudly from the talent agencies to individual celebrities who have spoken against Israel. We're not fearful anymore. And that group of celebrities that are speaking out is growing. There is a wonderful organization called Creative Community for Peace.
Yeah.
That works very hard to lift up the entertainment community. There was a convening that Variety sponsored as a conference on anti-Semitism. These things are happening more than we've ever had before. I know that there have been private convenings with President Herzog to educate celebrities, both Jewish and not, to educate sports figures, owners, managers, athletes, both Jewish and not, in ways we never have before. And I think you'll only see more and more of that.
Yeah. Let's hope. Well, Julie Platt, chair of the Jewish Federation of North America, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so that was Julie Platt, and as I maybe hinted in before, some bad news broke as we were watching Julie. The two more soldiers were identified as being killed today. One of them stands out as the son, Gal Eisenkot, as the son of the former chief of staff, Gadi Eisenkot, who's currently a member of the war cabinet. So this is obviously something that's going to have a more impactful, I would say, consequence on the Israeli psyche and potentially also on what how this war continues. But I want to shift back to our focus. Michal, you're at Harvard. We all watched with great interest the other day everything that the depending on context comments by President of Harvard Claudine Gay, as well as her colleagues from Penn and MIT. I mean, just on a very basic level, what are the feelings that you have?
I think we need to be very careful in the way we read this. I think our Israeli angle is to look at it as a show of anti-Semitism, which I think it has a lot to do with anti-Semitism. But specifically about those three women, the heads of the university, I think we have to look at it from a wider angle. And I think I'm basing this on a lot of conversation I had at Harvard Law School. I actually just came back yesterday from to Israel from the semester at Harvard Law School. Their commitment to free speech is real. It's not pretend. They really come at this topic from their commitment to free speech. Their intent to allow minority groups that are in danger of not being represented to speak and to defend that right. And especially if you look at some of those women, I myself went to the inauguration of Claudine Gay at Harvard 2 weeks before the war. I was very happy. It was a very inspiring event. The first Black president of Harvard and the second woman. It was a very inspiring woman. And then 2 weeks later, the war started and her reaction was less than ideal. But we have to understand when they speak about free speech, they mean it. The problem is, obviously, that this is a grotesque example of what happens if you take that belief in free speech and the will to defend it at all costs. It puts you in corners that are a grotesque example where you can't allow yourself to say that saying from the river to the sea or calling for an intifada is wrong. So we have to say these 3 minutes that we keep seeing circulating on the media are just 3 minutes of a much longer debate in Congress where they all denied, they were very firm against anti-Semitism on campus and they were very firm in their commitment to the safety of their students. But those 3 minutes, rightly so, was viewed as the most grotesque moment where it was very clear that the answer was, coordinated and was very legally phrased, because they were really sticking to that point of what does free speech allow and what doesn't, if we want to make it as wide as we can. I have to say, I had a conversation with one of my colleagues at Harvard Law School, and I said, I was horrified. I was walking in campus, and obviously I saw on a daily basis those people chanting and hundreds of students chanting from the river to the sea. It was a daily occurrence. I had security offered to my classes if I wanted to. It's a real, demonstrations are real on campus. So I had a conversation with a colleague and I said, would you allow Itamar Ben-Gvir to speak at Harvard about Shtei Gedot LaYarden, two sides to the Jordan, both of ours, would you allow such a speech on campus? And he said, yes, we would. So at least in theory and at least in ideology, they claim to be a proponent of free speech as far as they can take it. The problem is that they lost the moral compass. They at some point lost the ability to look and say, oh, this is wrong. This is very, very wrong. And they weren't able to do so. I think in the aftermath of this hearing, we can see that they're taking back, they're coming out with all kind of explanation and trying to explain why they said what they said. But I think this is an example of how grotesque that view, which I am a total supportive of, can lead to very weird and awful results.
Yeah, it's like the Ahmadinejad speech back in, I think it was like 2005 at Columbia University, the former president of Iran, who called for genocide of Israel and was still allowed by then President Bollinger of Columbia to speak. But Michal, I would be honest, I don't think they would have Itamar Ben-Gvir come speak, but it's a nice idea in theory for a school like Harvard. But it is painful. I mean, to watch even like particularly the president of Penn, who was all smirky in her testimony. And then late last night when she put out the statement, which she read clearly from a text that had been drafted clearly by PR spin doctors and lawyers, there was not a smile at all. But Laura, I want to get to you. The in Israel, this story did kind of get a lot of attention, not as much as, you know, maybe it's received in the American Jewish community because they are were a bit more focused, obviously, on what's happening on the ground. But the Israeli approach, I think, was more of there's zero tolerance for this kind of talk or comments of this sort.
Absolutely. I do want to say one thing, going back to what Julie said about women and what took so long. I just recently came back from Germany just the other day. And people did not get on to the women's issue because they do not believe Israeli spokespeople. They just simply don't believe what they're saying. And there is a disconnect between what we are seeing here in Israel and I think what Americans are seeing in the media also, which is probably much fairer than we are seeing in Europe right now, which is causing tremendous violence against Jewish communities. I will say that Jewish leaders in Germany, for example, their lives are really in danger. And so getting back to the universities in Europe and in Germany in particular, we also see a very kind of woke atmosphere. And what's happening on campuses in Europe is also what's happening in the United States. And there's a real problem. Now, there is not free speech in Germany. You cannot say whatever you want. You would never see the heads of universities having those kinds of conversations yesterday. Having said that, there is still a considerable amount of anti-Semitism that students are feeling there, and a lot of microaggressions. And there is real fear on the campuses there.
So Michal, the you know, but I'm just looking at some of the comments that we're getting. David Suisa, who is the editor of the Jewish Journal in Los Angeles, says in response to what you had said just before, that there's all kinds of speech that does trigger microaggressions on campuses. And it's more when it's Jews, and I'm just paraphrasing a bit of what David wrote, but it's more when it's Jews, it's allowed, right? And that seems to be a feeling that I think a lot of Israelis have. And by the way, you see that also with women, which Laura just mentioned, right? The fact that, you know, UN Women as an example, as an institution, is a total disappointment, of course, is a failure. But, you know, anyone else who would be raped, they would be out there on the streets with Jewish women. Well, we haven't seen any evidence. We don't know. It took them a long time to bend over backwards to make even a simple condemnation. What do you think?
So actually, I agree. So I think when I was quoting before is what I was told. I'm trying to explain. Obviously, I don't agree that the call from the river to the sea is a legitimate call. I don't. I also don't agree that calling for intifada is a legitimate cause. And I do think that this is something that should not be said. And then the policy should change immediately. But I'm just trying to explain why. What's their interest in saying such a thing? See, obviously, it's a public relation disaster for them. Why would they say that? And I'm trying to explain what they were doing. I actually agree. I think on the ground, you see a difference between the way they treat Jews and the way they treat other minority groups, definitely. And I think there's hypocrisy galore in a lot of those actions. I'm just trying to explain why they would take that position. Now, why would they put women, why they put, you know, Jewish women differently from general women? Why they would, you know, treat Jews differently? For example, they said in the hearing, they said that, for example, you can't say that blacks are inferior to whites in a class because that would, you know, that would not be legitimate because that would hurt someone in the class that would feel personally offended. Why won't they think that talking about Jews in Israel would not offend a Jewish student, American Jewish students in class, that's an interesting question in itself, right? That disconnect that they make. But there's definitely something that we have to consider in the wider lens of seeing Israel in a very simplistic way of the strong ones versus the minority group that needs to be defended. And if we are for Palestinian rights, and there is a lot to be said for that, then Israel is, no matter, you know, literally being butchered and killed, still are the strong one in that equation. So Harvard is trying to defend the weak ones, which are for Palestinian rights, and which is absurdly and grotesquely comes out in favor of Hamas. So it's also, this is and the reason that I think that we should all be horrified is that we are talking about the leading institution of higher education that trains all of future leaders of the world and is unable to rise above this simplistic division into something of a more complex nature. There is, you know, Palestinian rights, and there is Hamas, and there is, you know, Israeli's occupation, and there is Israeli's, you know, defending its right to defend itself. So we have to be horrified by the inability of these leading institutions to transmit, to attend, to acknowledge complex situation in which, you know, you should say enough is enough, and they are unable to do so. And I think that's horrifying.
Michal, I want to be cognizant of your time because I know that you just have a couple more minutes left. So I just want to get one more question. I'm going to go to Laura. One of the things that I found striking in the testimony, and you are at the law school, so you can explain this to somebody like me. Yes, I have a law degree, but it was all, you know, took a long time to get it. And I don't remember anything. They said, you know, incitement to violence is not supposed to be protected speech. But what they claimed is that it depends on the context. And if it goes from speech into conduct, then it would be something that, of course, would be harassment, which is insane in my mind, because I'm thinking you need to wait for them to commit the genocide for the speech of genocide to be a problem. Can you just explain to people like myself how that makes sense, even in a First Amendment type of, you know, context?
So first, you're asking the wrong person. I did teach at the Harvard Law School, but the Gruss Professor for Talmudic Studies. I'm a Talmudic scholar, so I don't do law. I don't do actual contemporary law, and I kept explaining and apologizing in class that I teach ancient law and not modern law. But what I understood basically about the conduct, and this is, I think, where we should be more careful. They didn't mean, and also, let's be very clear about this. The person asking the question at the hearing is a person that, for example, did not stand for the rights of Jews when anti-Semitism came from the right. When there were Charlottesville, protests and attacks in America, those Congress people did not stand up for Jewish rights.
So we and also supported the great replacement theory as well.
There we go. And in the worst conspiracy theory with the Trump support. So we have to be very careful when we're talking about. And also understanding conduct in this clear has to be understood in a legal context. And it's not about the genocide. Conduct here is meant in a very legal term. If the protests lead to conduct, that means conduct in the terms that it makes a student feel unsafe. A specific student on a Harvard campus. So if a chant of From the River to the Sea makes a student feel unsafe, that's incitement that leads to conduct. It's not about the genocide itself originally. So we have to be very careful. I think they were using a very legalistic language to try to, first of all, avoid lawsuits. Think about what it means. If they say that chant is not
abuse, then every Jewish student can sue the school,
or every professor or student who chanted it needs to be expelled or treated. That's a whole can of worms, and they made a decision that it's okay, and now to retract that legally, that's a problem. So we have to understand that they were being very legalistic. Again, I completely agree, and I think that needs to be said. I don't care. You have to stand and say, if to a direct question, is the call for genocide not okay? Yeah, not okay. And not on our campuses. And they didn't do that. And that's awful. And we have to understand why something that started off free speech and the defense of minority and pushing for, you know, the rights of, you know, Palestinian rights and women's rights and like all of that leads to that horrible position. That's something we should all think about. And I'm including myself in it as professors in these higher institutions and a graduate of Yale. and think about what it means that this is what we're teaching our students. This is that we can't, at the end of the day, lost our moral compass and saying, yes, we're for minority rights, yes, for free speech, but there's right and wrong, and a very clear right and wrong. And why, when it comes to the Jews and Zionism, we tend to have a very warped view of that.
Well, maybe instead of focusing on the legalese, they should take your Talmudic class. Maybe that would help them understand that you can manipulate the legalese a bit here or there. That might be helpful.
I will say one last sentence about that. So I was teaching at Harvard, and I'll tell a story. So I was teaching at Harvard this semester, the Jews and Christians and the law in the beginning. And I was teaching them just when the war was starting, and I was going into class when there were, still deads in the street in Israel. It was very hard to teach, and I was very honest about my feelings, and I brought slides, and I explained to the students, and I was crying in class, and I was going through the war with them, including an alumni weekend when I had alumni from the Harvard Law School come into class, and I talked about Jews and Christians in the ancient world. And I said, it's not disconnected. The strife, the interreligious dialogue that happened between Jews and Christians through the history, with its bloody history. I'm teaching texts from the Talmud, Jesus in the Talmud, and Church Father talking about the Jews, and we read this in class. It has a lot to do with what we're going through today. It's a different, religious interaction, right. But people are people and people, and there's a lot to do. And if I can end with a call for all of us to study history more, that's actually a very good message to have.
Michal, I know you got to run, so thank you very much. Laura, I want to move to you for a moment. You've spent time your husband, a former ambassador to Germany, so you spent time as the ambassadorial spouse in Berlin, I guess, is that the title or whatever the title might be? But also several years in Washington, D.C., working as a communications director. Mm-hmm. While Jeremy, your husband, was also stationed there and working with pro-Israel organizations. Mm-hmm. Something that Michal said that I want to touch upon for a moment is this: what does this mean for American elite institutions, right? And I think that the concern that I would have is that if these are the Ivy League schools, these are the schools that are churning out the top level people who are going into government, who you would meet at the White House or at Congress. Mm-hmm. What is happening here is something that we should be deeply concerned about, I think.
I think we really have a problem with the younger professionals that are going into government and going into media. They are often the ones, and I'll stick to media right now because that really is my expertise. What we're seeing now is people in their 30s and early 40s, they are making the decisions about what is being put on the front pages of our national newspapers, about what pictures are being shown, about what films or videos are being shown. And we know from our own JPPI polls and so many other polls that younger Americans are not as involved or pro-Israel as the older cohort is. And so there is really a change, and I think we're seeing that change. In Europe, it's disastrous. Whatever you think you're seeing in America right now, all you are seeing now in Europe is dead and wounded babies on TV. It's as if October 8th came and October 7th didn't happen, and there's a total focus on Gaza. They're actually calling what's happening now the war against Gaza, not the Israel-Hamas war. There is a total change in attitude. And so I think as we move forward, we are going to have a lot of challenges, much more than we're even having right now.
For Israel, for the Jewish people, and the situation that we saw this week, obviously at Congress, is something that's indicative of just some of those challenges. But also here on the ground, we're looking at, this increased offensive and the war and what that means. And we'll be getting to that in episodes to come. In the meantime, I want to thank Laura. I want to thank Michal. I want to thank Julie Platt, and wish all of you again a happy Hanukkah, Hanukkah Sameach. May the light defeat once again the darkness. I think it's very poignant right now as we think about everything that's happening on the ground in Israel and around the world, how much more important it is that we do have light in our lives. So thank you all, and Chag Sameach. Thank you.
Chag Sameach.